Virginia?
The same company that had the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in which 29 miners died. They violated the law 4,500 times in just 6 years. And they settled for $20 million. And then Alpha bought Massey. And the next 6 years after that, violated the law another 6,000 times. And they settled again for $27.5 million. And when I asked the EPA, do you think, given that history, is this a good way to handle this multitude of violations? The EPA said, well, yeah, they promised basically they'll stop doing it. And they paid us over $40 million.
So, again, the figure is less than 0.5% of violations trigger criminal probes. What kind of resources are our government officials working with here in terms of the agents they have assigned to these cases?
Very little. Across the country, there are just 200 investigators that focus specifically on environmental crime, and the Department of Justice has just 38 prosecutors.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we will link to your report. Graham Cates, deputy managing editor of the Crime Report. His investigation is called Environmental Crime, the Prosecution Gap.
And you are tuned into KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. You just got done hearing Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news after these messages.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6 p.m. to Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
We're now approaching Newport, Rhode Island.
KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m., at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Old Rockin' Chair's got me. Old Rockin' Chair got your father.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Federal Communications Commission has extended the deadline for comments on the future of the internet until Friday, after hundreds of thousands of comments caused their website to crash.
Union workers at Legacy Emanuel Hospital face the end of their contract with negotiations ongoing.
We'll get an update on Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip, which is now entering its second week after an attempted ceasefire was unsuccessful. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount.
And I'm Jimmy Tardy. Another brigade of Oregon National Guard soldiers are preparing this week for a deployment to Afghanistan. 275 members of the Oregon National Guard with the 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team will head off this Thursday to their second tour in Afghanistan. The brigade also served a tour in Iraq, and soldiers from within the group have served tours in Saudi Arabia, the Sinai, Kuwait, and Bosnia. The deployment of these guardsmen follows the send-off of 180 Oregon National Guard soldiers to Iraq in June. Another group of Oregon National Guard soldiers are still waiting to receive the settlement money ordered by a judge after they sued a Halliburton subsidiary for exposing them to hazardous materials in Iraq in 2003. The unit deploying to Afghanistan this Thursday will complete deployment processing and training at Fort Hood, Texas, prior to departure. Their job in Afghanistan will be to provide security and support for military facilities in Kabul and the southwestern part of the country.
Workers at the SEIU Local 49 have been in negotiations with Legacy Emmanuel Hospital since June for a new contract. But since May, workers have been making it clear that they would be expecting a new contract. Those negotiations aren't going very well, according to a union negotiator. Workers want more money for weekend work, as well as more freedom in choosing which weekends to work. The hospital wants to limit the amount of overtime shifts and end the practice of letting senior certified nurses leave early when work on the ward is light. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
Workers at SEIU Local 49 have been in bargaining negotiations with Legacy Emmanuel Hospital for some time, says Jesse Stemler, a representative of the local.
And, despite our bargaining team who's been there from day one really saying, hey, we need to make some real improvements to staffing and some problems we see with short staffing, some things we're seeing with basic rights on the job, and just in terms of a living wage that we really want to address. And it was clear from day one, I think, that the workers at Legacy were really, these were really important to them. And I think ultimately they're feeling like their voices are not being heard. And I think that frustration has led to what we had on July 9th, which was an informational picket.
That informational picket, which KBOO's Jamie Partridge covered, resulted, said Mr. Stemler, from those workers feeling that their voices weren't being heard. 580 healthcare workers, including certified nursing assistants, surgery technicians, housekeepers, and food service workers, protested in front of Legacy Emmanuel in an effort to get more money and better hours. That goal hasn't been very forthcoming.
My name is Mark Borpall. I'm a steward at Emmanuel Legacy. My job title is logistics tech.
Mr. Borpall is on the bargaining committee for the union workers, and when asked how the negotiations were going, he was blunt.
Well, so far, it's not satisfactory at all. We've gone in there. They didn't give us too many days to speak before the contract, to work this out before the contract was up. And we thought that they would maybe take the bargaining a little bit more seriously and not play the normal games to the degree that they have before. But, in fact, that's exactly what they do. And what I mean by normal games is they offer, they make offers that are just completely inadequate to what we need. And they're saying no to things that are just basic common sense.
I mean, these are people who, they provide patient care at all levels, from the time that a patient walks in the hospital to when they're in bed, and our members are providing care at all of those stages and those steps.
Now, a story in Northwest Labor Press says that what Legacy wants is to limit workers to 3 overtime shifts per 2-week pay period, and it also wants to end the practice of giving the most senior certified nursing assistants first pick at daily flexing, which I guess is an option to leave work early when a ward has fewer patients. And it also wants to have more control over the right to schedule employees on the weekend. I mean, these are a lot of the same kinds of labor issues that are affecting a lot of people in a lot of different kinds of jobs.
It's true. And it's, I think at the end of the day, our caregivers are, they have some good ideas. They're the ones that are providing this care day in and day out about how staffing levels can be improved. Some of these things are cost neutral. Some of them obviously are not, but I think there's our members are frustrated that their voices aren't being heard. And, in terms of issues of seniority, there's basic rights and there's basic agreements that we have had with the hospital that are pretty standard, that it's looking like management's trying to roll those back. And it just, our caregivers are really frustrated by this.
A lot of this stuff seems to be brinkmanship. I think anybody who's watched the news and seen labor negotiations played out over TV or radio or in the newspapers knows how this works. I mean, it'll go to the 11th hour, and then eventually there'll be some kind of reasonable agreement. But I guess one of the questions I want to ask is, as someone who is bargaining for these folks, why does it always have to go through that cycle before you end up getting to something realistic?
Well, some of it is, inherent in the bargaining process, but, you can tell by the offers that, the offers that they're putting forward, you can kind of get an idea of what they're aiming for. And, what we're seeing is that they are basically, they're basically thinking that they can, go ahead and keep such things as our cost of living increases, our step increases, down to, where we were when we bargained with them during a recession.
Okay, so then you said that it's not going satisfactorily, but do you have any indication as to when you might get to a point where the negotiations start to get serious?
No.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Doug Cunningham, I'm Joanne Powers. Thousands of activists and dozens of organizations will be descending upon downtown Detroit at midday on Friday in order to protest the city's water department cutting off services for tens of thousands of low-income residents. Since April, the department has initiated 1,500 water shutoffs every week, targeted at the city's poorest residents, for owing as little as $150, while ignoring the debts of wealthier businesses and organizations owing hundreds of thousands. The United Nations has declared the shutoff a violation of human rights. Maureen Taylor, state chair of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, is among those trying to put an end to the water shutoffs.
It's just scandalous. Now you can't even have water. It's bad enough that the jobs that we used to have where we could manage our homes and our families, those jobs are gone and replaced today with $7, $8, and $9 an hour jobs that you can't raise families on. And now this. Now you can't have water. Outrageous.
MWRO and others have repeatedly offered the utility a water affordability plan, which would have eliminated water shutoffs and ensured a revenue stream for the water department, but the utility has been unresponsive. Meanwhile, protesters have been holding weekly Freedom Friday pickets in front of department headquarters, aimed at the shutoffs, as well as the wholesale privatization of city assets following the city emergency manager's decision to declare bankruptcy 1 year ago.
We're not a bankrupt city. We're being bankrupted. Things are being stolen from us, and things are being taken from us. At the end of the day, they're trying to find a way to privatize the water department so it no longer is a common good. It now becomes a commodity that you can buy and sell. In order to make the water department seem like it's an excellent purchase, you have to make it clear. This water department, if you would like to buy it, it can generate some serious funds for you. We're standing up as best as we can to see if we can prevent that from happening.
At the American Federation of Teachers National Convention last weekend, President Randy Weingarten called on her members to be a little bit badass in their fight to stop ongoing attacks against public education and labor unions. AFT Vice President Louis Malferro echoes that sentiment, stressing that unions aren't intended to be debating societies.
Unions are institutions of action where workers come together around shared values, make changes. Sometimes that's getting into the ditch and struggling with your opponents. Talking about this alone isn't going to do it. We've got to get out there and we've got to kick some butt. We've also got to get out of our own comfort zones. We've got to work with community. We've got to work with parents, with faith leaders, with immigrant rights groups, LGBT groups, people who are advocating for full access to health care. Those are our fights. That means breaking some eggs along the way.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A group of artists hope to create a nonprofit to manage Alberta streets last Thursday in response to recent decisions made by Portland Mayor Charlie Hales. Hales recently implemented more rules and restrictions for the monthly event after complaints from Alberta area residents. New changes include stricter monitoring of musicians for noise violations and a 9 p.m. end time. Hales has also been considering imposing fees for some vendors. The organizers of the new group, Michael O'Connor, believes that the new policies will cause harm to good people. The new Last Thursday organization would be a membership based and free to join for musicians, artists, and performers. There will be a fundraiser this Thursday at the Knockback at 2315 Northeast Alberta Street to raise money for the group's state registration, IRS filing, and website. More information can be found by calling the Knockback at 503-284-4090 or go to the Knockback or email the Knockback at gmail.com.
When it comes to kidney dialysis patients who undergo treatment in the Portland area, it can be hard to get around after leaving facilities for those who do not have transportation. Ride Connection, a nonprofit organization that serves as a transportation service for dialysis patients, is working to focus efforts in helping the houseless community who are faced with transportation issues once they leave treatment. TriMet has cut back its paratransit services in the past year, leaving many without transportation to and from services. This afternoon, KBOO's Sequoia Wright spoke with Troyce of Ride Connection about the development to help patients get better help with transportation services.
My name is Troyce, and I've been an Oregonian my whole life in the Portland area, and I've had kidney disease for 26 years and experienced all forms of treatment. And I now am working for a nonprofit in Portland called Ride Connection that provides transportation for aging and disabled folks. And they handle a lot of transportation for dialysis patients, and we're trying to improve that situation. What we're dealing with is the dialysis treatment is a four-hour period of time, three times a week for folks to maintain their lives with no kidney function. And when we're done with treatment, we tend to be pretty washed out and weak and tired because we get dehydrated from losing all the fluid that we lose on dialysis. And so public transportation that takes care of us don't realize what our needs are. And a lot of times patients can be stuck on a transportation provider's bus or van for a couple hours after their treatment, which is terribly debilitating. And it actually can really contribute to a worse health condition. So we're trying to improve that for folks.
And what are the ways that you all are trying to improve that?
Well, what we see and what I've seen personally through the years in watching the situation is really a matter of education. These folks that are driving us just aren't aware of our particular needs and how we need to be handled. And so we are creating an education program that will be able to educate our volunteer drivers to the needs and the specific needs for dialysis patients so that we can get them on board and that we can make these trips more efficient so that folks are going right from their treatment to their homes to be able to eat and rest and not have to be spending 2 hours with a transportation provider going all over town.
And how will this help those who don't have homes, like the houseless? Have you guys figured that out, or is that something that's also in the works of figuring out as well?
Well, yeah, a part of the issue there is us trying to identify where we're seeing these folks that are homeless, because what's happening with us, to be on dialysis, you've got to have an address to be able to have your Medicare and Medicaid and the other services that are, you know, absolutely necessary for us to get treatment. So somebody on dialysis is providing an address one way or another. So we have to do a little, especially if people don't present their own information to us, we have to keep things pretty anonymous that, you know, what we're doing is a transportation program. And the dialysis providers do not like us prying into any patient information because of HIPAA. So we're working on how to make sure we get access to everybody, but it's kind of a slow process when part of the organizations don't want to talk to you about this stuff.
Recently, well, not recently, but within the last year or so, TriMet has canceled Lyft services for the disabled. How has this impacted Ride Connection?
We definitely have seen some increase in the need for our services since that has happened. And actually, myself and another representative that works for Ride Connection met with TriMet's Board of Disabled Transportation, with Board of Aging and Disabled Transportation, and we talked to them very much about what I'm talking to you about today, what the needs are of patients and how we need to be served and how important it is that they do continue that service for us. But we definitely have seen a change and an increase in our rides. And we know through our surveys and patient advisory council and our advisory board that really less than 10% of people on dialysis can walk from their treatment to the bus stop and ride a regular train at best home.
Okay. And so moving forward, Troyce, I understand that you're looking for volunteers to help in terms of volunteer driving. How are you reaching out to folks and how can people reach back to you?
Folks that are interested in volunteering for Ride Connection and helping improve transportation for dialysis patients, as well as our aging and disabled population in Portland, can contact us at 503-528-1738.
I have been speaking with Troyce, Operations Specialist for Dialysis Transportation for Ride Connection, and he's given us an update on the recent transportation issues for patients who are on dialysis. I'm Sequoia with KBOO Evening News.
A federal judge has sentenced Holly Grisby, the woman who helped her boyfriend David Peterson kill four people in the Pacific Northwest in 2011 to life imprisonment. Grisby pled guilty in March to one count of racketeering in connection with the four murders and related offenses. U.S. attorneys wrote in a sentencing memorandum that Grisby remained unremorseful and unflinching in her beliefs and recommended that she spend her life in prison. The states of California and Washington will not be trying Grisby. The two were arrested in 2011 following the murder of Peterson's father and stepmother in Everett, Washington, an Oregon teenager, and a man in California. The murders took place after Grisby and Peterson attempted to wage a white supremacist revolution targeting Jewish organizations. Joey Peterson is to be sentenced in August.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with local activists about the ongoing violence on the Gaza Strip. That's followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Jace Marcus, a George Fox University student who was denied housing in an all-male university housing building because he is transgender. Out Loud will also be speaking with queer female DJ Action Slacks later on in the show. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock will speak with Monica Lewis-Patrick for We the People of Detroit about the water crisis and privatization. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and beautiful with a high of 86 degrees and a low overnight of 59 degrees with increasing clouds.
In today's broadcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 29 counts per minute in North Portland, 32 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 35 CPM. Hanford, Washington has a count of 33 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 36 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, a Pakistani judge convicted four political Islamic fighters in the kidnapping and killing of journalist and correspondent David Pearl on July 15, 2002. The quote of today is by political freedom fighter Assata Shakur, who said, quote, "Nobody in the world, nobody in history, has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who were oppressing them." Unquote. It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's hard not to ridicule Congress's Tea Party Republicans as a group of mad dog againers who do nothing but run around in circles yapping, "No way, we're again it." But at last, they've come up with something they're for: the impeachment of President Barack Obama. The mad dogs of the right yap that this president is flaunting the Constitution and bypassing Congress by issuing executive orders and making scads of recess appointments. Two words: Bush-Cheney. Their White House didn't just use executive orders to raise the pay of working families or extend health care to uninsured Americans, but to send more than a million Americans into a war that was an ideological folly based on executive branch lies. In fact, George W. issued more executive orders than Obama has. So did Daddy Bush, and so did Reagan, Ford, Nixon, Ike, Hoover, Coolidge, Harding, and Teddy Roosevelt. Oh, and about those recess appointments that are causing the Tea Partiers to foam at the mouth? Obama has made only 32, but George W. Bush made 171. Without a peep of protest from those who are now thumping the Constitution and demanding impeachment. The chief reason that Obama has had to use recess appointments is that Republican senators, prodded by their extremist Tea Party partners, have routinely misused the procedural device of filibuster obstructionism to block the qualified people Obama has appointed. Here's a historical perspective the yappers won't mention to you. In less than 6 years in office, 82 of Obama's presidential nominees have been filibustered by the Republican Tea Party. In the previous 220 years of U.S. history, the other 43 presidents combined had only 86 of their nominees blocked by filibuster. This is Jim Hightower saying the Tea Party, which started with such legitimate outrage, has just become ridiculous.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Attorney General Eric Holder has praised a settlement made with Citigroup ordering the company to pay $8 billion as a groundbreaking measure. But a quick glance at the settlement documents show very little information about what Citigroup is accused of doing. Despite years of investigation, thousands of documents collected, subpoenas issued to hundreds of personnel, the final presentation of evidence in the case is just 9 pages long. Those 9 pages contain no details on the wrongdoing carried out by Citigroup, despite a mountain of evidence against the bank. This has led some analysts to speculate that the settlement between the federal government and Citigroup includes a clause that the evidence will be kept hidden from the public. For more, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke to Susan Beck, who writes a column for the online magazine Litigation Daily.
What is the evidence that was presented by the Attorney General against Citigroup?
Well, the problem is there just isn't much evidence that's presented. If you look at the documents underlying the settlement, the only real evidence that the government presents is one single email that was written by an unknown trader on an unknown date to an unknown person that indicates some concern about the loans that were being put into these securities. But, you know, that's the only hard evidence. The rest is just very generic descriptions of what everyone already knew Citibank was doing.
And obviously, though, Citigroup was involved in other crimes. Otherwise, there wouldn't be this litigation and this settlement. What are some of the potential crimes, and where is that evidence?
First of all, it's important to point out that this is a civil settlement and not a criminal settlement. So there weren't any criminal charges at issue here. It was all civil litigation. Citigroup was also, as part of this deal, settling claims related to its activity in this market called the collateralized debt obligation market. And that activity was nowhere mentioned in the documents and nowhere mentioned even in the press release. So even though Citigroup sort of avoided charges on that activity, there's no mention of that activity at all in the documents, which is very odd.
So what we know is that Citigroup sold bad mortgages or bundled up bad mortgages and then sold them to investors. That's what these collateralized debt obligations were. Did the government investigate that kind of transaction that Citigroup was involved in, those collateralized debt obligations at all?
Yes, and just to clarify that this settlement involves two different types of securities. One are what are called residential mortgage-backed securities, which where loans were bundled up. The other are an instrument called collateralized debt obligations, which are slightly different. But anyway, the government looked at apparently lots of evidence. According to its own press release, it collected 25 million documents and issued 50 subpoenas to get testimony from individuals, which again sort of raises questions about why there's so little evidence presented in the court documents, or actually they're not court documents, but presented in the documents.
So why keep that evidence from the public? Do you think that was part of the terms of the settlement agreement with Citigroup, that the government would just sit on that evidence and not make it public?
Well, to me, that's the big question. If that was the deal that Citigroup struck with the government, you know, I wonder if Citigroup said, look, we will pay $7 billion or agree to a deal valued at $7 billion, and in exchange, we don't want you to reveal some of the more damaging evidence that you unearthed. Now, I don't know. I'm just speculating. I don't know if that's the deal they reached, but, I mean, there's one huge category of activity, the CDO activity, that's not even mentioned in the documents. So I don't know. That's an important question, I think, that needs to be raised.
Well, thanks so much. I've been speaking with Susan Beck. She is a journalist, writes for American Lawyer in the Litigation Daily blog that can be found online at litigationdaily.com about the agreement made out of court between the Department of Justice and Citigroup, a $7 billion settlement reached yesterday. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Openly gay Republican Carl DeMeo is facing criticism from both sides of the political spectrum as social conservatives find him too open about his sexual orientation, and the left considers him to be too quiet on social issues. DeMeo is one of three openly gay Republicans running for Congress this year, but he is the only one who managed to make political adversaries on both sides, on both social conservative and gay rights organizations. The 39-year-old former city councilman DeMeo runs against incumbent Representative Scott Peters in a race that is considered a toss-up by the Cook Political Report. The two other gay Republicans, Dan Innes of New Hampshire and Richard Tesey of Massachusetts, have so far avoided being targeted by social conservatives, and both received endorsements from Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund, which called them pragmatic and visionary leaders, whose election would, quote, shatter a glass ceiling for the Republican Party. The organization said that DeMeo never sought its endorsement. DeMeo said that the story is more complicated, dating back to 2012, when the group declined to endorse him when he ran unsuccessfully for mayor of San Diego. He said they also gave insider campaign information to his opponent. DeMeo quotes, I am not going to let their partisan politics deter me from what I see as the important role I can play, which is to be present in the Republican Party, to go hard to win audiences and social conservatives and stand and say, I am openly gay. I am proud and it shouldn't matter who I love. Let's talk about the issues that united us, not divided us. That's what DeMeo said.
Early Tuesday, the Federal Communication Commission's electronic filing system crashed after being overwhelmed by public response to the agency's proposed net neutrality ruling. We talked to FreePress.net Timothy Carr about what this ruling could mean and how the FCC has responded to the public backlash. Henry Lachey has more on the story.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about Tom Wheeler and his proposal. So in for the FCC, what was in his proposal?
So Tom Wheeler is the FCC chairman, and he proposed earlier this year to put forth a new rule that he thinks will protect the open Internet. The problem is that it actually does the opposite. The rule that Wheeler has put forward would allow Internet service providers to pick winners and losers on the Internet. They can sell special fast lane services to a few wealthy companies and, in effect, push the rest of our websites and services into a slower lane. And this is what's called prioritization or online discrimination. And he has basically put forth a rule that would allow that to happen. That is exactly what companies like Verizon want to do. Verizon's lawyers were arguing late last year before federal judges that they want to be able to prioritize certain traffic over others. And the problem, of course, is that fundamentally breaks the open nature of the Internet. It disrupts the level playing field that has been a hallmark for free speech and innovation online since the beginning of the Internet.
So how would this proposal change things if it were to go through? How would it change things for kind of the average Internet user?
Well, it would change our Internet experience. It would give priority to services that strike special deals with your Internet service provider. So, you know, if you look at, for example, the story of Google, Google is a search engine that was started by two grad students in Stanford. They started it in their dorm room. They put together a very good search system, and it actually rose to become the dominant search engine in the industry because people actually liked Google. They liked what they had put forth. But under the scenario that Chairman Wheeler is proposing, there would be no Google because the Internet service providers, companies like Verizon and AT&T, would prioritize their own search engines. And so the kind of innovation that has allowed these kind of startup companies to succeed on the Internet would be stifled. And for consumers, that means you don't have the choice of the best services out there. You have a choice of services that Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T think that you want, or services that they will profit from at your expense. And even when they charge companies like Netflix to pay a special rate in order to get their video streaming services to work properly, those are fees that would then be passed on to consumers. If you are a user of Netflix and Netflix is subject to these kind of prioritization schemes, Netflix will, in order to pay Internet service providers, pass those costs on to their customers.
Early on Tuesday, the FCC site crashed. What made that happen?
The FCC has set up a comment system through which the public can electronically, they can go online, and they can comment to the FCC. And we've been urging people to contact the FCC and urge the agency to protect net neutrality. Well, that site that was set up by the FCC received so much interest. There were so many people making comments that it crashed early Tuesday morning. It's been sputtering throughout the day, and it's gotten so bad that the FCC has just announced that they're going to have to extend their comment deadline from midnight today, Tuesday, until midnight Friday at the end of this week.
Thanks so much. I think that's all the time we have, but we really appreciate you speaking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
We have been speaking with Timothy Carr about the FCC's proposed net neutrality ruling and the public's response on the FCC website. There's still time to respond to the FCC proposal. The comment deadline on their website has been extended until midnight on Friday. For KBOO News, I'm Henry Leisha.
That was KBOO's Henry Lachey speaking with FreePress.net's Timothy Carr.
Immigration activist and journalist Jose Antonio Vargas was detained this morning attempting to leave McAllen, Texas, a town on the U.S.-Mexico border. Vargas was sent to fly to Los Angeles to attend a screening of his documentary film documented when he was detained by U.S. border officials. Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who publicly outed himself as undocumented in a 2011 New York Times Magazine article. He came to the United States as an unaccompanied minor from the Philippines. He has a passport issued to him by his native country of the Philippines, but lacks a visa that allows him to spend time in the U.S., even though the United States is his home. The renowned writer and filmmaker went to McAllen to visit a shelter there for unaccompanied Central American refugees and to attend a vigil for them. The advocacy group Define American has called on President Barack Obama and Secretary Jen Johnson to immediately release Vargas from the Customs and Border Protection. He wrote in the magazine Politico last Friday that he went to the border town to change the narrative surrounding immigration in the U.S., but Vargas now finds himself in the same situation as the people he came to support, unable to leave McAllen.
July 20th is the deadline for an agreement between Iran and Western governments regarding that country's future nuclear program. Iranian Foreign Minister and Chief Nuclear Negotiator Mohammad Javad Zarif said in an interview on Monday that Iran could be open to accepting a deal that allows the country to keep producing nuclear fuel at its current level, but prevents Iran from increasing output for several years. But Zarif insisted that Iran should be treated like any other nation with a peaceful nuclear program. The parties involved in negotiations with Iran on its nuclear policy are the United States, France, Russia, China, Britain, and Germany. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton is coordinating talks with Iran on behalf of the six nations. The proposal currently on the table would effectively extend a limited series of concessions Iran made last November as part of a temporary deal to begin negotiations. In return, Iran wants step-by-step relief from sanctions that have substantially weakened its economy.
The Iraqi parliament has elected a moderate Sunni politician as Speaker of the House today, thus achieving a political breakthrough that could ultimately lead to the formation of a new government. This is the first official to be selected to form the new government more than 3 months after Iraq's parliamentary election. But after quickly picking Salim al-Jabouri as speaker, lawmakers argued for hours over who should be his Shiite deputy. The argument suggests that lawmakers are still far from a deal on a new government or a decision regarding the fate of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The recent effort to begin installing a government in Iraq comes after the United Nations' warning of chaos if politicians failed to begin building a government. The political crisis came to a head in recent weeks when militant fighters from a group calling itself ISIS began taking over cities, and the Iraqi parliament was unable to take decisive action due to a political deadlock. Now Iraq's divided political parties must still agree on the presidency and prime minister. Some political analysts in Iraq believe that Jabouri's assignment as speaker is part of a wider intent to ensure Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will not hold power for a third term.
Israeli airstrikes in Gaza killed 7 people today, including an elderly Palestinian man in Khan Yunis. Additionally, a 25-year-old was killed in a drone strike in the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of eastern Gaza City. The 2 deaths raised the toll to 7 for Tuesday and 196 in total since last Tuesday. One Israeli was killed by a Palestinian shell on Tuesday, marking the first Israeli casualty in the 7 days since Israel declared the operation. Egypt claimed to have brokered a ceasefire deal on Tuesday morning to end the Israeli aggression in Gaza, but Hamas officials claim that no one contacted them to negotiate, and they only heard about the alleged ceasefire through the media. According to Israeli sources, the agreement calls for Israel to stop the attacks on Gaza while Hamas stops firing homemade shells into Israel. Hamas and other resistance groups in Gaza rejected the ceasefire proposal, saying that it amounts to surrender, adding that no representative of Hamas or any other armed resistance group had been involved in the negotiations. They asked how could they be expected to be part of something that they weren't even consulted about. In addition, the Egyptian proposal does not meet the four key elements reiterated by Hamas leaders in recent days. These requirements include the lifting of the Israeli siege of the Gaza Strip and the opening of all borders to allow aid, construction materials, and fuel, as well as staple goods to enter Gaza. The current Israeli military operation began 1 week ago today on Tuesday, July 8th. It has since resulted in 194 Palestinian casualties and one Israeli casualty.
For the latest news and developments from occupied territories in Palestine, we go now to the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, July 15th, 2014. The Israeli offensive on Gaza enters its eighth day. Death toll reaches 196. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, invading Israeli soldiers continue to clash with local youth. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources announced that a Palestinian old man and a worker were killed on Tuesday afternoon in two different Israeli airstrikes targeting central and southern Gaza Strip. The death toll, up to the time of this report, have reached more than 196 and more than 1,500 injured since Israel started its attacks on Gaza 7 days ago. The sources added that 40% of those killed since last week are children. Moreover, among the 1,500 injured, there are 500 injured children, medical sources announced. An Israeli civilian was killed by rocket fire coming from Gaza on Tuesday, according to Israeli army. This is the first Israeli death reported during the 8 days of cross-border violence. The man was fatally wounded near Eretz crossing at the borders with Gaza, the Israeli army said. On the political level, the Israeli Security Cabinet reportedly agreed to a ceasefire agreement proposed by the Egyptian government on Tuesday. However, leaders with the Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza said that no one had contacted them to negotiate any ceasefire. Despite claims of having agreed to ceasefire, Israeli bombardment continued to pound Gaza on Tuesday morning. Elsewhere, clashes continued between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian youth in a number of West Bank communities. Local sources said that the Israeli forces invaded the central West Bank city of Ramallah, as well as Hebron and Bethlehem cities in southern West Bank. Earlier on Tuesday at dawn, Israeli troops invaded the city of Bethlehem and kidnapped one legislator and three other civilians. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, July 15th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Hassan Bannoura.
The jury trial for Portland human rights activist Ibrahim Mubarak begins today. The Right to Dream 2 founder was charged with trespassing and interfering with police while doing outreach to houseless people in downtown Portland. We'll have a full report on tomorrow's evening news.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Hillary Devaney, Henry Lacia, Emily Saul, Muhammad Nabil, and Don Merrill. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jimmy Tardy.
And I'm Kristen Yount. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, it's Political Perspectives. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Eric Castagadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Food Show, Paul Greenberg talks about his book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Also, food and wine stories from Chehalem Valley winemakers. And Ryan Drum of Island Herbs talks about his seaweed, about seaweed and radiation. Thank you so much for listening to KBOO, and thanks for all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not yet a member, you can do so by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the Donate Today button.
On tonight's KBOO News In Depth, we turn to KBOO reporter Jamie Partridge. He was on the scene at a local protest this weekend calling for an end to the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. Jamie spoke with several local activists about the issue. Good night.
Good night, Jimmy.
Good night, Kirsten.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jamie Partridge with KBOO News. I'm out here at Pioneer Courthouse Square. There are dozens of people gathered to protest the Israeli attack on Gaza that's been ongoing for a few days now, and we're expecting hundreds of people to show up. It's 11 o'clock on Saturday morning. I'm here with Wael, and you're founder of Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. Tell us why we're here today.
We're here today because of the ongoing assault of the Israeli assault on Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank. That's killed at this point over 100 people. It's injured nearly 1,000 people. But I think a lot of us are here for even more than that. The state of Israel has continued to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian people. One of the sad facts for a lot of us is that we have actually been out here year after year to continue to respond to these attacks by Israel. So this isn't some kind of reaction. This is part of a larger policy that Israel has carried out. And it's at the core of what the Israeli state is. That is an ethnic exclusivist state that wants to get rid of the indigenous Palestinian population. And I think people around the world need to stand up and say no more to that. And one of the really important points, I think, is that this can be even worse right now.
Why don't you tell us why Americans should be concerned? What's the U.S. role here?
The U.S. role is absolutely essential. They're completely complicit in this. Every single bomb that drops on Gaza, every single raid into the West Bank has been supported by the United States. First off, militarily, to the tune of $3 billion every single year to Israel in the form of military aid. And this is at the same time, by the way, that $0 are going from the federal government to for the drinking water that's being cut off in Detroit. Instead, $3 billion going to kill Palestinians. But on top of that, it's the political and moral support that the U.S. government has given to Israel year in and year out. So it's absolutely our responsibility to stop that.
Now, the Obama administration is putting forward signals that they're trying to restrain the Israelis.
I think it's absolute nonsense. If they wanted to restrain the Israelis, they can do that right now. This can stop tomorrow morning if they wanted to. All they need to do is say that the $3 billion a year in aid that the U.S. Provides is ended, that they'll stop vetoing resolutions in the United Nations, that they'll stop supporting Israel politically. So this is absolute nonsense what they're putting forward. If they wanted it to end, they would have. They don't want this to end. They want to try to deflect their responsibility while continuing support. It's up to the people in this country to force our government to end that support.
So you mentioned the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. How can our listeners get involved with that here?
There's two primary ways that people can get involved. One is through a campaign that's being against SodaStream. SodaStream is a company that is built in settlements, illegal settlements, and it's been targeted by the BDS movement. And we've scored very big victories against it recently. It had to close its flagship store in London, and its stocks have plummeted. But people can get involved in that through Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and the Palestine Solidarity Coalition locally. And the Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights website is auphr.org. That is offer.org. And then the other thing that folks can get involved in is with Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, who is set to challenge the Portland State University's complicity in Israeli crimes. Last year, the American Studies Association courageously took a stand and said that they will honor the boycott of Israeli academic institutions until Israel ends its human rights violations against the Palestinians.
One, two, three, four. Occupation no more.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Israel is an apartheid state.
One,
a sign reading Operation Protective Edge, which is the name given to the Israeli assault on Gaza. 100 Palestinians killed, zero Israelis.
Five, six, seven, eight. Israel is an apartheid state. Free, free Palestine. Israel, USA. How many kids have you killed today?
I'm talking with Mohammed, and you have family in Gaza. Tell us what's going on with your family in Gaza.
You know, basically, it's miserable. You know, it's the first time for my house and my family since before 2005 that they had to leave their house, and they had an injury in their houses in Gaza. So that if it focuses on something, it focuses on how severe this operation is and how hard it is. Before yesterday, my neighbor's house was demolished totally without alarming, except 5 minutes before it's being bombed. So it's end up like my neighbor getting out of the house, but they did not have the ability and the time to let all of us, which is their nearest neighbors, to leave our houses to be protected. So what happened is, when they demolished the house, all the pieces and the shrinkles of the rockets bombed and damaged all our houses, and it injured my cousin. His name is Yasser, in his belly, and now he is suffering, and he did not awake yet after the surgery, and they had to take half of his colon because of this 10-centimeter piece of a rocket. That it's an F-16 rocket that it weighs 1 ton. Like, imagine 1 ton of bombs being hit there. My family, all of them, end up being leaving, and till now, they cannot go back to home because it's dangerous, and the same place that being bombed before, it's being alarmed that it will be bombed again.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Gaza, Gaza, we are here. Tell your children not to fear.
Gaza, Gaza, we are sky over Gaza tonight.
People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our minds. we will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night, while the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. But through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
KABU and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present one of the great concert films of all time, Jazz on a Summer's Day, a documentary of the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Jazz on a Summer's Day captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m., at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm